You know me. I like to talk about myself.
All right. So today is March 30th, 2016, and I'm Nicole Barnes for the University Archives Oral History Program, and I'm sitting in the Geography Library of Science Hall with Matthew Edney, who is the director of the History of Cartography Project. Matthew, would you spell your last name just for the record?
Surely. E-D-N-E-Y.
Perfect. So we'll just start off with a little bit about when you were born, your background, family. Just get that out there.
Sure. So I was born in 1962. My father was a self-employed businessman, entrepreneur, although he just spent some time unemployed before becoming a self-employed businessman. And my mother was the quintessential homemaker. She tried to do a degree in biology, but had dropped out for various reasons. So, born in southwest London, and grew up in the borough of Kingston, part of it called New Morden, and went to the local schools, public schools, which were very good. But my abiding memory is one of unjustness to a degree, because I'm the youngest of three, and it shows. And the way that you go through a school system is that you get tracked, and there comes a point where you get split, and it's completely arbitrary in the sense that there are so many places in the higher level of post-11 schools. So they only want to train enough people to pass the test to fill those slots, and everybody else gets stuffed into the general comprehensives. And so my sister went through it. She got tracked high, and so she went to class 1A with Mrs. Sedgwick and did very well, and ended up getting a federal government grant to go to a private school, Serpentine High School, for girls. And my brother, who is more intelligent than either my sister or I, ended up not being tracked well because he doesn't do the tests, and ends up failing the 11 plus because they don't get trained in how to do the test. And he goes to the secondary comprehensive. But I, on the other hand, can do standardized tests very well, so I ended up being tracked well and do very well in the 11 plus exam, and I end up getting a grant to go to Kingston Grammar School. So whereas my brother had a fight for a decent education and ends up frankly going mad, he's better now, thank you, I didn't. So I went to this great school, did all sorts of wonderful things, but I ended up having a really bad teacher for history, who did not like what I was doing in history. And to be honest, I didn't like the subject matter that was taught. I would like to say, I can tell you everything you want to know about the Reciprocity of Treaties Act of 1839, but actually very important for the establishment of free trade. But so I was quite happy to not be doing well in O-level history, but lo and behold, once I get the actual O-level test graded by somebody else, I get an A. Oh, look. But by that point, it was too late to do history at the A-level. Mm-hmm. So at A-level, I did my other side of things, which was, maths, physics, and geography, more on the physical side. And my plan was to go to college and become a land surveyor.
Oh.
And, put it this way, I thought, originally I was going to become an artillery officer, but that failed because I screwed up my knees playing field hockey.
Okay.
And at that point, they could pick and choose who they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So when that bailed, I thought, I'll just go to college to do geography because I can do geography. It's really easy. And maths and physics are a bit harder for me, but geography is very easy. And so when I was looking at colleges, the idea was, University College London geography program, you can do all these courses in land surveying. And I'd always been fascinated by maps, right from, I assume I could write. Used to trace maps out of my father's atlases. So the idea of going to University College London and doing a degree with a whole bunch of stuff in land survey courses sort of rather appealing to me. Mm-hmm. So I end up going, life is fine, and do these courses. But also there, I discover there's this wonderful subject called historical geography. And so out of the electives, half of my elective courses are in land surveying, computing. The other half were in historical geography. And my advisors had no idea what to do with me. They really didn't. It's just, well, let them be, whatever, and we'll see. So everything was great. I ended up getting a first. I was only one or two in my year. But in my last year of the degree program, I did this incredible class with the late Hugh Prince, who, by the way, was the doctoral advisor for Roger King.
Oh, really?
So this class was called Research Methods in Historical Geography. And I've spent most of the last 30 years living off it in some respects. It's the first time I read Yves Antoine. It's the first time I read anything in the Yamal School. And it was a brand new book, just come out, called Period and Place in Historical Geography. And Hugh said, go read this. And there's a chapter in there by some guy called J.B. Harley, called How Historical Geographers Should Model Their Evidence. And half of his examples were old maps. And I'm thinking, huh, that's how I can take these two sides of my interest, you know, the technical land survey with all the high-level geodetic math and calculus and stuff, and the historical side that really appeals to me, the idea of how, you know, the spatiality of the past. And so I thought, maybe, perhaps, I could do a PhD and something to do with map history. No idea what, really. So I wrote to Brian.
Where was he at that point?
He's at Exeter.
Okay.
No, still at Exeter. And this is early 83.
Okay.
And I remember writing, the chair of the geography department, the head of the geography department at UCL, was Bill Mead, who wrote Volume 3 on Scandinavian mapping. He just died last year.
Mm-hmm.
Bill was a big Scandinavian historical geographer. And when the geography department moved to new, brand new concrete monstrosity of a building, Bill stuck up in the stairwell between the ground floor and first floor this big color facsimile of Olaus Magnus Carta Marina, the one with all the pictures of sea monsters mm-hmm. and stuff. And so for every day for 3 years, going up and down that stairwell, I would see this map and the iconography of it. So when I worked with Brian, completely unaware that he'd been actually at this point already writing about the iconography of early maps, I start talking about the iconography on this map and how the Swedish stance towards Russia is warlike versus the stance towards Finland is gay and party. So net result was Brian sort of was looking for money, but the structure is different in the UK. I was trying to work on a system to do something through the British Library, but Helen Wallace just didn't really want to know. And at this point, Hugh Prince said, well, have you thought about America? Hugh had been one of this generation of post-war British scholars, like Malcolm Lewis, who co-edited two books, three with David. who had come to America for a year or two and had thoroughly enjoyed themselves in graduate work. And so I said, no, give me some names. And Hugh said, well, there's Norman Thrower at UCLA. And even I had heard of UCLA at that point. If only, you know, 1970s realist American cinema, there's a lot of references to colleges and UCLA and the football teams. So fine. And I wrote to Norman, and I never got a response. I don't know if he got the letter or didn't get the letter or whatever, but you know, as much as I like the man, I really can't stand the work he does. So I'm really glad he didn't
dodge the bullet.
So there's Norman Thrower at UCLA, and then he's mentioned David Woodward at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Which my first thought was, when God's name is Wisconsin, let alone Madison. So I wrote to David. I did it via, I made an incredibly astute political move because I didn't know what the heck I was doing. It's a pedo accent. I wrote to David Woodward through David Ward, who was then professor of geography and I think assistant dean, associate dean in the graduate school. Mm-hmm. This is before he went marching up through the ranks.
Yeah.
And by the time I did my dissertation, he was in the chancellor's office. So David Ward always thought he should have a say over what's in the history of cartography project. He was quite imperialistic in some respects. So it just somehow I just managed to salve David Ward's ego by doing it this way. David Ward didn't care. So then it turns out that David and Brian are doing this big multi-volume history of cartography project that they had. Well, they've got first money for in 81, and they were waiting at that point to hear about the next round of funding, which included money for a research assistant. And the money came through, and I got the degree, and so next thing I know, I had this, I was ranked well for the land surveying. The land surveyors wanted me to do a master's degree in land surveying. And they had funding for 5 places from the Natural Science Research Council. And I was a top-ranked candidate for that, so that funding was guaranteed, short of the whole program being denied. So I had that funding, and then I had this option of, they want to pay me to go to America and play with old maps. Cool. So much to my surveying advisor's annoyance, I bagged on them and went to work, came to America. Mm-hmm. Although subsequently, Arthur Allen wrote for Volume 6, and I had some correspondence with him, and in the middle of which he said, yeah, you made the right choice. So in the fall of 83, I end up coming here. Mm-hmm. Utterly naive, no idea what the heck I'm doing, no idea about the nature of US academia, no idea about much of anything, but knowing that I'm really interested in maps and surveying and so on. So
were you one of David's first?
I was David's first new recruit.
Okay.
He inherited a couple of students from Arthur Robinson, who he replaced. And there was Jane Kamiri, who ended up doing a PhD in biology on the history of biological illustration, and she was somatic mapping. She worked a lot on Berghaus Physikalische Atlas. Jane, I don't know the story. I don't know why, but there was clearly a falling out.
Okay.
And Jane went off to biology. So I was the first of David's graduate students that he recruited,
mm-hmm.
in that sense. Later ones were Kevin Kaufman, who worked on the project. And there were some others, but mostly, in the hierarchy of graduate students, they're the guys who just get along, mm-hmm. and the guys who get support and are good, and then you have the few who are the professor's student.
Sure.
And most faculty never have such a person, but
mm-hmm.
somehow I was that category of David's
mm-hmm.
student.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in 83. David only ever told me, you will take one course, his course in history, Geography 577,
mm-hmm.
History of Cartography, that first semester. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course. But because I had done my undergraduate in Britain, I'd done a honors dissertation, I met all the prerequisites. So I had a great deal of fun doing... every semester I did 3 classes and took them to this taking them. So every semester there was one class in geography just to meet those requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And then one class in either history or history of science and another class in math and computer science. Which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a ball. This place for graduate school is just absolutely amazing. If you've got the capacity to explore, it's such an amazing place.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great deal of fun for 7 years.
Okay.
Worked on, I won't bore you with the details because they get tedious. Bounced back and forth a bit, but ended up doing a dissertation on British India, which is sitting on the shelf over there. Did the master's degree in December of 85,
mm-hmm.
On the late 19th century US surveying mapping,
mm-hmm.
the strange little hybrid, partly federal, partly state, and then the PhD in May of 90 on British mapping of India,
mm-hmm.
pre 1843. So, in terms of the project, I worked for the first 2 years as illustrations editor for Volume 1,
mm-hmm.
which would eventually come out in 87. And after that, I left the project knowing that if I ever wanted to come back into the project as something more than just a basic researcher,
mm-hmm.
I needed to have some other status, so
mm-hmm.
divorce myself a bit and
mm-hmm.
come back in later. So I spent 2 years as one of the PAs in charge of the computer lab, departmental computer lab,
okay.
that just got created,
mm-hmm.
Setting impossible standards for everybody who followed me, unfortunately. Then 1 year as teaching assistant, Geography 127, Physical Systems of the Environment,
mm-hmm.
which was fine because that's all my undergraduate work.
Did you know early on that you liked to teach? Like, even as a TA, was that...
That's a good question. I'm not actually sure that I like to teach.
Okay.
I'm not the kind of person... To me, teaching is a very draining experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so... because essentially, I'm an introvert, although I might not seem it that way. So I'm one of the people who... Dealing with other people takes it out of me.
Mm-hmm.
So teaching can be very tiring. A really good class, I'm coming like, don't talk to me for another couple of hours because I get my brain back into gear. So I'm not one of those people who has a good time in the classroom. I'm effective and a good teacher, but I'm not I don't consider them, I don't see it as a good thing. And I hate grading with passion. God, I hate grading. Which is why I hate editing.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Oh, God. Loathe editing with a passion. Come on, guys, if you're an expert, you should be able to write this stuff without me having to rewrite it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. But I did find that 1 year quite good and revealing. I do have one immensely amusing story about it. When I turned up in fall of 83 here with my strange half middle class, half working class Southwest London accent, a lot of people had a hard time understanding me, which I understand. And I was, 5 years later, I'm in this classroom, I'm teaching, and it's down on the second floor in one of the labs. So there was a temporarily empty office right next to it, and they stuck a visiting professor in there. And a friend of mine, one of the grad students, was standing outside in the corridor waiting to go in to speak to this professor. And she said later, "You know, Matthew, I understood every word you were saying." You're like, "Oh my God, his accent has changed." So there was that year teaching. That was the fifth year. Then the, and I also did some extra bits of work for the CART lab. They had a machine crash, like a redevelop some of their hard drives. I had to reprogram one of their in-house databases that somebody else had made for them and made it badly, and I had to go in and redo it.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. So then I got 1 year of research money in to go to London to hit the archives. Natural Science Foundation, this stage a grant, and then a virus fellowship from the grad school. David was quite chuffed at both of those. And then one last year, piecing together a bunch of things, I have to admit, Art and Jan Holzheimer are the nicest donors ever, because they came through with enough money to take an extra fellowship and turn it into an actual livable wage.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew my money was expiring at the end of 1990,
mm-hmm.
Academic year. So I had to finish. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Although part of it was going back into the project. David needed some help trying to bring an entry, the chapter on the Islamic Geodesy, up to shape. So
mm-hmm.
I hacked at that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then decided, no, I need to get away for a few days. So I did a road trip out to Utah with an old friend.
Oh, nice.
It was fun, in the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm.
More stories. So, yes.
We're up to 1990. Do we want to take a step back and just talk about the beginning of the project? Since
sure.
We have it peppered in,
just
for background. Do you want to, can you tell us? The origin story?
The origin story, yes. And it's been written about several places, myself in volume 6, David's own work in the 2001 Catalan publication. Essentially, 1960s, 1970s, there's a disciplinary anxiety when map historians don't quite know what it is they're doing. There's the traditional form of map history, people who call themselves historians of cartography, librarians, dealers, and historians who are doing really bad, looking at the content of maps with nothing beyond where did this information come from and not to wonder about why or how or anything like that. Then you have the a number of academic cartographers, which includes David Woodward, because he himself came from Britain to Wisconsin to study with Arthur Robinson because of Robinson's design interests. And David was one of these people who studied the history of design But his first goal was modern academic cartography. The history was the way to get to that. So David was from that angle. And from that angle, the people were interested in the how. How do people make the maps? Well, surveying or cartograph design, map printing, which David focused on. And then the third group were historical geographers, people who, like Brian Harley, were interested in looking at early, mostly large-scale maps for the information they have about pre-industrial landscapes. And so Brian had made a very successful career for himself studying the early Ordnance Survey, and even before that, the 18th century county land surveys. And there, people like Harley, John Andrews, a number of others, their interest was in not just the how the maps were made, but also why the maps were made, because they're coming at it from a very historical point of view. And if you're going to be an historian, you've got your basic tenets of historical criticism. Is it Langlois and Sembo, that classic late 19th century French work that Harley always cited? You know, you've got your internal and your external criticism. And so for both internal map work and in map history and historical geography, there's a tendency to move into the social context, why the maps were made and what does that have, what significance does that have for the map that's resulted, but then also for the content. Ultimately, they're all interested in the content. So you have these three different groups, and after the war, they start to interact in conferences and in prints and journals, books and journals. And it's a big question. So what is this field? Armando Corazon in Portugal gets fixated on this question. Skelton in the mid-60s. And in 69, for example, David and Brian met for the first time in the International Map History Conference, International Conference History Cartography, 1969, which is in Brussels. And after that, David wrote to Brian in December of 69 saying, you know, we need more structure. David argues through the 70s one way, Brian argues another way. The bicentennial, by this point, David is at the Newbury Library. And so 1974, the Nebenzahr lectures for that year, leading up to the 1976 bicentennial of the United States, the subject is mapping the American Revolution. And so David inveigles Brian to come across and do all this research on early stuff. And ultimately, this is published in 1978. And David pushes Brian to do some interesting stuff. And Brian is getting involved with the mapping of North America. So it all boils down to a visit that David took to Exeter, well, Newton Abbot, where Brian lived, just outside Exeter. And they were doing Brian's favorite Sunday afternoon stroll. And on the pathway up to the church, where most of Brian's family is now buried, with the exception of Sarah and one sister. And on this stroll up, Brian says, you know, we need a four-volume history of the mapping of North America. And David says, no. Before that, we need a four-volume history of cartography, history of the endeavor of cartography. And Brian said, you know, you're right. So they started exchanging outlines for what it would be. I don't think David had an idea when he said four-volume. He's just reacting to... Brian had an idea of a four-volume to North America, and David just sort of riffed back off that. But they boiled it down into sort of ancient medieval, Renaissance, Enlightenment, 19th century, with a heavy emphasis on Europe. Because at that time, there really wasn't much interest in the non-European cartography. And the goals were basically... they were really bibliographic, foundational. the idea was that so much people, so much in the 60s and 70s, people were just doing the same old thing. And you look at an article in 1950 on a topic, an article in 1970, and it's like, and what's new? There's nothing new in here. It was spinning the wheels almost. So, well, the idea was for the project was to be a comprehensive overview of the literature. What do we know? What don't we know? In a way to almost like a gigantic needs and opportunities study. And in addition to being a big history of a discipline that hasn't had its history retold as an endeavor. So they embarked on this project, and pretty quickly they realized that dealing with non-European cartography is an issue. So they first get funding. What David moves up to Wisconsin in 1980 to replace Robinson, who'd retired. At this point, his own work has gone firmly into the Italian Renaissance. He did the Fulbright year in Italy, and was interested in sort of not just map printing, but how does map printing relate to the Italian Renaissance as a whole. So he's got that going for him as well. So he moves in here in 1980, they put in funding to NEH, first grant comes in, starts July 1, 1981, and they start the medieval stuff, classical medieval. And they realize, how do we do the rest? The initial plan had been, well, we'll do the rest when Europe gets to the rest, because most of what we know seems to be through Europeans. And they had a meeting, 82, maybe early 83, at the Winstead Museum, big conference center over by Milwaukee. I think it's at big architect who's famous, used to be a Spring Point, Taliesin.
Frank
Lloyd Wright, thank you. I think it's a Frank Lloyd Wright place. And they had a big conference there, specifically about how do we handle Asian cartography. And as a result, they decided to separate out all the Asian material and make it into volume 2. So when I was talking to Brian Harley in early 83 in London, who was interviewing me both for Exeter and for David, he was explaining, we just decided that we're going to go up to 6 volumes. We're going to add what will become volume 2 will be the Asian material, and then we'll tack on a 20th century volume at the end, volume 6. So, and he says, in 1983, and it's not going to be volume 2, the Asian one, it's not going to be very big because not much work has been done on it, because they're still thinking in terms of this, we're working around a bibliographic statement rather than a big disciplinary statement. And as you know, volume 2 grew into 2 books, volume 1, book one, volume 2, book 1, volume 2, book 2, that are each larger than volume 1, on top of which they then added volume 2, book 3, after Brian died, because Brian had this question, so how do we do indigenous cartography? And Brian was insistent, we know everything only through European engagement and encounters, so therefore we need to talk about indigenous North American mapping in the context of European encounters, same with Africa, Australia, Pacific. And David was never quite happy with that. So after Brian died in December 91, David had the opportunity to rethink this with Malcolm Lewis, and they tacked it on to make volume 2, book 3. And this was announced in 93 at the Nabenzahl lectures in 93, which were tied into the History of Cartography conference. At the end of which, Art Holzheim had his party at his house up in Forest Park. And I distinctly remember David saying at that point. And you know what? It's not going to be very big because not much has been done on this. He's still thinking that mentality. And lo and behold, Volume 2, Book 3 grew to be quite large, about the same size as Volume 1 in his own right. So they began with this sort of idea to be a grand comprehensive statement, bringing together all the literature. And as they get into it, they start realizing, well, we've got some problems here. Number one, what's a map? So Brian has started already at this point. You know, going back to that disciplinary anxiety, what is the history of cartography? What is, what are we doing? One solution is there's sort of an institutional question. How do we create an institutional identity for the field? And that's largely been achieved through the project itself and through international conferences. There's the bibliographic control issue, and you see this issue coming up all the time. Bagroff, in about 1912, tries to create a unified bibliography of the history of cartography. Eckert, in 1920s, is saying we need to have a comprehensive bibliography. So that aspect is still going strong. And then the third aspect is an intellectual question. That really was what Brian was pursuing on the side. So by 1980-81, we've got his work with Michael Blakemore on concepts in history of cartography and so on. So going into the 80s, there's this secondary theme that's been brought to bear on the project, which is more of an intellectual political question. You know, over time, through the 80s, from what I could see, and what David said, David and Brian had a working relationship which was, in some respects, very similar to Mary Petty and myself on Volume 4, which is, these essays would come in, Brian would read and just start rewriting about society, about culture, bringing all this stuff in. And David would then take it all out, turn it back down again. So, you know, there's an interesting dynamic there. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions for Volume 1 was, so, you know, what is a map? You know, if you talk, what is cartography? You're talking about the history of cartography, then the defining what a map is a key aspect of that ring fencing you need for this new discipline. For my dissertation comprehensives in spring of 86, one of the questions that David set me was, for my comp on history of cartography, was the editors of a new general history of cartography have come up with this definition for a map. Comment.
Mm-hmm.
And is essentially what gets published in Volume 1. It didn't have the word graphic in it. So for my comp, I immediately responded saying, well, you know, you should probably have the word graphic in there because otherwise, you know, a novel could be because it would be a map.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would say, yes, it's a map, and I would actually take out graphic.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, in the 80s, that seemed to be important, so that was added to the final project. But that's a definition that they only really came up with at the end of the volume, as they had already figured through all this stuff about medieval work and the classical work. So that's when, so that definition, which some people take to have been the driving definition that motivated the whole volume, Volume 1 anyway, is very much a post hoc rationalization. The other thing about Volume 1 that is relevant in this sense is if you look at the authorship in Volume 1, there are a couple of points. One is there's a whole series of essays by the editors with material supplied by Germaine Aljac, is the formula.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this French scholar had written all his work on the Greeks and Greek mapping. And Brian and David had really wanted to take this into beyond a basic statement to something a bit more historically, culturally sensitive, sophisticated, say what you want. And they went too far. And Aljack could not live with the results. Mm-hmm. And I only know this from the outside, so I never met Germaine Aljack, so I don't know if she's just because she's one of these prickly people or really, really committed to an empirical point of view. I don't know. So they came up with that nice formula. Then you have the problems like medieval Mappi Mundi, where they had contracted with a very reputable scholar who knew something about this. But all this guy wanted to do was to just give a list of these are all the maps, medieval maps of the world, with no attempt to actually say why they were made, pattern of their distribution, or anything like that. And so in the end, they had to fire that author, and David had to write that chapter himself. So I knew what I was getting into, like, to go with the project in that sense. And that's become one of the most amazing chapters. It has its problems. For a start, David's not a medievalist, and he'd be the first person to admit that. It is a first grand cut at a really interesting, complex field. But that's the thing about the whole of Volume 1. The whole volume is that first cut at a really interesting field. So it's prompted huge amounts of scholarship within classical studies. That means that the entire classical portion is out of date. The Tony Campbell on marine mapping, David on Mappa Mundi, Paul Harvey on larger scale terrestrial mapping have all stimulated a huge amount of more empirically grounded work that's made most of those chapters also fairly out of date. So just after I took over in 2005, there was a conference at British Columbia, part of the medieval history symposium that Richard Unger organized. So Unger and Richard Talbot co-organized this session, this symposium on classical medieval mapping. And all I got when I got there to represent the project was, Volume 1 is out of date. When will there be a new edition? To which my immediate line was, I just need to finish the series, and at the end of it, maybe we'll do something, depending on how the institution develops. But I don't have a lock on this. Now, if you want to rewrite, you want to do a book on the history of classical mapping, be my guest. This is not a statement for the ages, and Brian and David never intended it to be that way. It's a foundation to start new work that succeeded admirably. Mm-hmm. So, and Volume 2 is on exactly the same thing with Asian Indigenous mapping. And we're starting to see signs that Volume 3 is also starting to push people to expand and rethink and develop new ways of doing things.
So that would be, though, a long time in between the initial publication of Volume 3 into that.
Right.
Appreciation and reception of the ideas in it. Was that true with the earlier volumes?
Well, I think with the earlier volumes, it was. Volume 1 came out in 87, and you have the Roman historians, Richard Talbot in particular, but can't think of his name. They started a debate in about 6, 7, 8 years later about how did Romans think about space. Volume 2, Book 1 came out, which is South and Southwest Asia. And that's had a strong impact, but there are far fewer South Asianists and Islamicists in academia than there are classicists or medievalist for that matter. So the effect has been a lot slower, a lot more diffused. But I think it's fair to say it's finally kicking in now. Especially with some interesting work comparing Islamic to Chinese mapping. So that's developing quite nicely. Asian cartography is really booming now. I mean, that came out in 94, Timbuktu. Mm-hmm. And there's been a steady upsurge to the point where Chicago has just published, and I'm waiting to get my copy, a new book called Cartographic Japan, which is a series mm-hmm. of essays, short essays about particular maps that cover a very wide period. So indigenous mapping is, to some degree, is taken off as well. So it's, yeah, I mean, take a decade or so
it's a slow process.
For that. For the later volumes, for 2 book 3, for 3, and certainly for 4, 5, and 6, a lot of the impact is actually getting authors to rethink how they do things. So there's a bit more of an immediate effect. So for volume 3, what David did was he had the 1 million word budget for national context, onto which he added a whole bunch of interpretive essays, 300,000 words worth. And he unfortunately didn't get the chance to cut 300,000 words from the rest, which meant that the volume was way over size. So with those interpretive chapters, really did prompt their authors to think through in new ways. And so those have been very, very important in many respects, I think. The 4, 5, and 6 are important because they're encyclopedic structured. We have such a large body of people writing for us that we're sort of chivvying along a large number of people mm-hmm. to think in new ways. And I think that has had an effect. So it is having an effect. And there are a few people who have said so in print, and I can demonstrate it. So all of which goes into our federal grant proposals. So the project began with his walk in 1977, first funded 81, and it's grown ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Jude can give you the detailed history of the project. She's been with it since 81.
Mm-hmm.
I came in 83 through 85, stepped away. And in some respects, I consciously decided to stay away from the details of the individual volumes. They weren't doing anything I was expert in. And secondarily, you know, volume 3 in particular seemed to be David's second dissertation. And just look at their graduate student. If they're your student, fine. You ask them how the dissertation is coming along. If they're not your student, you don't raise the question because you don't know. It could be good. It could be bad. It's a very stressful process. And so with David, I never wanted to raise the question. So how's volume 3 coming along? Because it could be really well or it could be really frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, people have often assumed I know a lot more about that period than I actually do, other than the fact I have access to some of the files.
Right. So that's the early 90s, and you, at that point, were finishing your dissertation.
Right,
so
I finished in May 90,
mm-hmm.
and when I looked at the job market, there were precisely 4 jobs I could apply for in geography. Florida State was a reach. I was a straight GIS person, and they said, really interesting, but no. The other 3 all gave me interviews. UCLA, because Bill Clark, W.A.B. Clark, then the chair, really wanted to hire a student of his buddy in Bristol. And so he needed a second non-US candidate. So he could go to the Labor Department and say, the only other person we can interview for this job is also an American. Give our guy a labor certification, please. The grad students at UCLA didn't get this. And they later thought that the reason I didn't get the job was that they couldn't believe I could be good at both computers and the history. No, it was purely political in that sense. The Syracuse was possible. I was interviewed at Syracuse, but they were so far behind the curve on the application process. I already had the job offer from the fourth place, SUNY Binghamton, when I interviewed it at Syracuse. So I had a withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Which is good and it's bad. Syracuse had its good things and it had its certainly bad things about it. So I ended up at SUNY Binghamton. Which, with hindsight, when I first saw the job ad, it was like, where the heck is Binghamton? Rather reminiscent. Small department in the process of being rebuilt after the 80s when a dean decided they're going to slash the department at the same time as everyone was slashing Northwestern and Michigan and Columbia and so on. So I was hired primarily to teach computer cartography. I could do it in the language of C, brilliant computer language. I used to know there's like five ways you can code plus one in C. I could, if I judge my memory, I could figure it out. But I did a bit of historical geography, world regional geography, and so on. And that was a fun place to be. The geography department had a master's program, which was really focused on urban planning, applied geography, stuff I don't really do. That's fine. So I found intellectually I was more at home elsewhere. So when I quit to go to Maine, by that point my relations with my there's a couple, husband and wife couple who ran the department, and over the 5 years I was there they got progressively more galling to be within this framework, and this rather dictatorial framework. If you went along with what they wanted, life was fine. If you had any other ideas to do anything else, then... So that was getting really frustrating, and I was getting very angry being there. So I needed to get out for that reason alone. But the... So it took me great... I took great pleasure in the number of people from around the campus in different departments who came across saying, Matthew, you're leaving. And as they were get to my office, had to go past their offices, and so they saw this guy from sociology and history, information technology, and art history, and people coming by. So, yay! So on the one hand, Binghamton was really good. On the other hand, Binghamton as a place sucked. Industrial armpit of New York. And I'd like to say, you know, if your navel is New York and your head is Watertown and you put your arm out to Buffalo, and Binghamton's right in the armpit. It's gotten better recently, but the last year I was there was the last year of Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo, who was called the education governor. In 5 years of Binghamton, I had one pay raise. There was no cost of living pay raise. This was purely merit, and it was minimal. I mean, it was, the dean felt so sorry, she actually doubled the amount. It was still nothing. So when I had a meeting with the dean at one point, she poured out this book. Didn't know it existed. Listing faculty salaries by region, by discipline, by rank. And I looked at assistant professors in New England And for each, you've got max, min, and median. And I look at minimum. That's me. So there are all sorts of issues in New York, but not the least of which ultimately was the fact that my teaching was in computer cartography, early GIS, and I did some granting around that area, doing some work for some guys in Pennsylvania, created basically a simple GIS for them to digitize tax parcels, very easy way. But the problem is, at that point, there were no data sets readily available. Census Bureau had Tiger files, but you still had to pay for the CD with them on. And Tiger files, like any federal data set, just, oh my God, that's such a badly designed database. It's not true. So most people who were doing GIS and teaching GIS needed to be generating data sets. And way to do that is through your own work. But my research was all historical still. So there was a sort of tension there. So this job at Maine came along that allowed me to be just in the history of cartography. And so on the one hand, I learned a huge amount at Binghamton. Not least, I actually got a grounding through the 80s. I sort of knew who Foucault was. And there were, I think, allusions to that in my dissertation, but I didn't actually start reading Foucault and Derrida and all the rest until I started hanging out with a couple of art historians in Binghamton. And so that's been a different process there as well. So moving to Maine, let's see, big fat pay raise. I could just do a history. Beautiful part of the world, unlike Binghamton. Binghamton's beautiful nature, just industrial hole. Mm-hmm. So it was a good move.
Mm-hmm.
Into a tiny university that's, at the time, was growing and aggressive. Mm-hmm. And since then has sort of, best, different story altogether.
Right. So you were able to focus on your historical analysis of cartography. How were you keeping engaged with the project, if at all? You consulted a little bit on Volume 2. Did you keep in touch with David as a former student?
Well, yeah, as his former student and friend, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about David and Roz, David was a very shy man. But we realized we had some fundamental points of interest. We had a very similar sense of humor. And even though our work was markedly different in terms of empirical emphasis, it was, in principle, very similar. So, yeah. So one summer, for example, somewhere between New York and Maine, I had a fellowship from the Friends of the UW Libraries to come for a couple of weeks and use the library. So I did that, stayed with Dave and Roz, and life was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Roz, on the other hand, figured out that she liked feeding me, and I like eating her food, so always did that. So, yeah, so there's a personal relationship, but it was a very low-key relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Again, as an introvert, I've never been somebody who actively maintains friendships. But we make quite sure, if we're at conferences together, there's always food and drink and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The other factor, actually, that may be relevant here, about the early 90s, Brian moved to Milwaukee in 86 as part of Milwaukee's attempt to do something more with the AGS collection. They're in the Golden Mere Library. And he died in December 91. And then they started this long process of trying to figure out what are we doing? You know, do we replace Brian? Mm-hmm. Brian had been a difficult faculty member with hindsight. You know, even at my last couple of years as a grad student here, I knew enough grad students there to know there was weird stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dean was absolutely amazed when Brian died and he got a bit in amongst the quality British papers, there was a huge memorial service that people came from all over for. He just saw Brian as this guy who just causes all these damn troubles. So Milwaukee didn't quite know what they were doing. But eventually they decided, yeah, we need to hire somebody at Milwaukee to replace Brian. And it was a very interesting period because the historians loved the idea. The dean loved the idea. And it turns out that the dean then is an old buddy of one of the historians at Binghamton, who's an Ottomanist, since died, unfortunately, one from there. And so that the Ottomanist had been hired to do one of the periodic disciplinary reviews of a program. And so he came back to Binghamton saying, hey, Edney, you're at the top of the short list for this position and it gets funded. And the dean really wants to fund it. And so they open up this position, and I apply for it. And I hear nothing, and I hear nothing, and I hear nothing. And it gets to be March, April, and it's time for the AAGs in San Francisco that year. So fly out, get to the hotel, go down to the exhibit area to New David will be. For some reason, the project had an exhibit table in the exhibitors area. Found David. He said, we need to go have a beer. And we went to the bar around the corner from the hotel, company site. Got some beers and said, yep. They closed the search. And I subsequently found out that there was one faculty member in geography who, if she had pushed a bit, position would have gone ahead, but she didn't want an historian of cartography and geography. She wanted another straight computer person.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the most frustrating conference ever, because I spent the entire conference talking to current recent grad students who are all interviewing with this professor from Milwaukee for this position. And she's not returning any of my calls or messages until the very last day. And so that position died at that point. And later on, I tried to talk to people about getting something better at Milwaukee. But that didn't go anywhere because, again, there was no money. So, very frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
So, all this is to say, you know, there's part of that relationship. Oh, okay, there's David. Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was. So I came back to Madison a fair bit when I was at Binghamton, see friends and stuff. You know, you do when you leave it.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a first 2 or 3 years when you come back, and then you try to make your social network grow in where you are, so you stay there more.
Right.
But we talked a lot about various things, and in 98, David started to talk about, Volume 2 of Book 3 is coming out. He's been talking with Mark Momineer for a while, as an old friend of David's, about a 20th century volume. He's looking, you know, what we're going to do. So he's thinking, well, you know, if I rope in Mark, he's already had this great experience with Malcolm Lewis as a co-editor for 2 Book 3. So maybe he ropes in some people to do the other stuff. And so he'll focus on Volume 3. And then if Mark and he will do volume 6, and he knows nothing about enlightenment, so maybe he brings in a couple of people to do volume 4. And then, because he began as a 19th century person, he can then deal with the 19th century. And then we'll be done. So, 98 is when he calls me and says... and for some reason, I have a memory of talking to him on the phone about Volume 4. I'm placed in my office at Binghamton, which means we had to be talking about it before 95, before summer of 95. But 98 is when we finally do the contracts and everything else. It must be through the mid-90s, the mm-hmm. mid-late 90s. David's idea was to have me and Graham Burnett co-edit Volume 4. And that's fine. My initial reaction was, Graham's a bit too self-serving. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really have a lot of knowledge with the French stuff.
It's a little important.
So maybe we need somebody else, because the 18th century is really French. I mean, that's hallmark of French matter from the 18th century. So I said, you know what? I think we need a third person. I think we need Mary Pedley.
Oh, so you recommended Mary.
I recommended Mary. Mm-hmm. I don't know if David had already thought of Mary mm-hmm. as a possibility. But I certainly said, and I think Mary's the person. And David accepted the idea, or it affirmed his existing idea, I don't know. And Mary said yes. And so we started. And so, 98 came back for a couple of meetings. We had a meeting here, we had a meeting in New York. Graham had a fellowship in the New York Public Library, so we had a meeting there. And talking about the nature of the last volumes, the problems with size, mm-hmm. The press was absolutely clear. 1 million words is the limit for each individual volume, 2 bindings. Anything more is just unwieldy. I mean, 1 million words is bad enough. So how do we take, you know, a subject that has grown both in terms of now by the late 90s because of Volume 1 and Volume 2 has grown in interest, has grown in the nature of the interpretations and the number of different interpretations, so that the treatment needs to be more comprehensive, needs to be fuller. And at the same time, after 1450, you have this massive flourishing of mapping for the Renaissance volume. So volume 3 is going to be a million words to cover it all. So what about 4 and 5 and 6? Because after 1650, there's another upsurge of cartography, and after Napoleonic Wars, and after the First World War. So, during and after these wars. So, there's no way you can do this huge amount of stuff with all the new interpretations and realizations that there's not just the professional cartographic literature, but there's these historians, and art historians, and culture historians, and literature historians, and everybody else, and sociologists, and even political scientists are interested in this, something now. How do you bring it all together and stay within this pragmatic limit of 1 million words? And the only solution, really, is an encyclopedic format. Now, it happened that one of David's friends here at UW was Paul Boyer, who had been the lead editor on the Oxford Encyclopedia of American History. And Paul explained to David a lot of the process and allowed David copies of the internal structure, form papers and stuff that they developed. And so the initial idea in the late 90s, we would do an encyclopedia. We would do it. We knew that it was going to be two printed volumes, two bindings, covering totally a million words. So the initial idea was we'd have an encyclopedia volume, encyclopedic part for the empirical data, and then the other binding would be the interpretive essays. And we talked about that, and it sort of makes sense. And I remember David was then doing his 5-year stint at the Institute for the Humanities, which used to be up at the observatory. And I think it was March, because it was cold, yet sunny. And after one of these meetings, we were walking back to David's house, and we needed to go up to the observatory to his office there, his real bolt hole where nobody knew where he was, and pick up something. And by the time we got from Science Hall, walked up to the observatory, we decided that no, the problem of overlap between the interpretive and empirical side was just too great. Cross-referencing, it just opened up a real organizational nightmare. And we had reviewed in that meeting enough of these documents from Paul Boyer to realize that you can have interpretive entries that an encyclopedia does not have to be simply factual. And so we ended up with this format of interpretive, factual, and summary entries. And then we had to figure out how to design the entry, how to design these damn volumes. And so 4 is going to be the first one. And so Muggins here decides, okay. Because there's another problem as well. Not just in terms of size, which requires something to control the size. And the good thing about an encyclopedic structure is you contract by words. So you know, you can control your physical size. None of this problem with the earlier volumes of contract for 10,000 and you get 200,000 words in, you know. Yeah, that's a long story for that one. So you can control the physical size through the structure. And fine. But the other reason to go encyclopedic is that there's a need to... Well, two more reasons, actually. One reason is that as you go later from the 18th and 19th to 20th century, the amount of historical literature shrinks. So for the 18th century, there's actually a large literature, unfortunately. But for the 20th century, there's almost no literature on the history of 20th century cartography at that point. There's more now, but still not a huge amount. So we're looking at volume 6 to make a really good splash in that regard. So an encyclopedic structure seems to be helpful in terms of being just a fax man approach for the 20th century, allowing more interpretive for the 18th century. Then the final factor is that when you get to the 20th century, cartography as an endeavor is by and large an international affair. You look at these atlases produced in China and Russia and America, and the scripts and the languages may be different, but the aesthetic, the size, the kind of content, the way it's presented, is pretty much of a muchness. So we need a way to go from volume 3 with its really nationally based essays. You've got your French cartography, and within that you've got marine mapping, terrestrial mapping, property mapping, let's say. From that in the Renaissance to an more international approach in the 20th century. So it made sense to me to rejig the volume, so put it on its side, and by rather than going by nation, by type, let's go by type and then by nation. So that way, by the 20th century, it's mostly by type with a bit of regional variation just for empirical coverage. And so I designed volume 4 around the concept of modes, and I identified 9 primary modes, which I can recite if I remember. Probably mapping, topographical, boundary, like political boundary, and marine charting, urban, geographical, thematic, celestial, and geodetic. Makes 9. So, and then we got these various, and then spent some time looking at the national context. We trolled through all sorts of sources, trying to figure out other things we should talk about. Particular maps or map series, particular houses, particular individuals. And we just started creating this entry list. Mm-hmm. And it got huge, and we whittled things down, and it got huge again, and we whittled things down. And David and I had an argument or two, because the process of doing one of these encyclopedias, by this point we were working with Linda Halverson at the press, who had been hired by Chicago to head a new reference books division and to do the Encyclopedia of Chicago, the Encyclopedia of the Child, and a number of these big encyclopedia projects. And Linda had expertise in Oxford as well. She's saying, what you do is you create your hierarchically integrated conceptual clusters, or HICs. And given that Mary is a classicist, it became the Hick Hike Hock on Hancock. So the idea is that if you were doing an encyclopedia of American history, you have different kinds of American history: diplomatic, military, social, cultural, political, and so on. And so you have, within each of those, you've got some big-level topics, and you've got some low-level topics, and middle-level, you know, hierarchically integrated conceptual clusters. You use those to generate your entry terms, and then you realize that, you know, under diplomatic history, you have people. Daniel Webster, who did the Webster-Ashburton Treaty that defines the U.S. boundary, 1842, Treaty of Washington. If you have Daniel Webster as an individual, you're going to want to know the same kinds of things about him as an individual as you would about General Patton, under who come up on the ministry cluster. So you then end up running sort of across these. You create these categories for which you can write a scope description that tells the contributor address these issues. Because for any individual, you want to know birth, death date, we'll know family background, how they were trained, what their career was like, within the context of this large, whatever the cluster may be. So you write these generic scope descriptions. So you've got the conceptual clusters, and then you've got the categories. And David kept wanting to dive straight into the categories. And I'm like, no, we do it this way. David never liked the clusters. Mm-hmm. Could not get his head around the clusters, for whatever reason. Anyway. So, we proceeded very slowly. Mary was still teaching. And then, by 2003, we were moving along. Mm-hmm. And so what happened? Let's see now. David, right, so Kathy went to Michigan in 2003. She went 2003. So my wife decided to go back to do a PhD, and Michigan State offered her a good contract. So that's right. So summer 2003, when Maine hosted the International History of Cartography Conference, spent the beginning of the summer buying a house. Spent the middle part of the summer running this conference, and then spent the fall going out and moving out to Michigan. It was a busy summer.
Yeah.
So summer 2004, I get a fellowship, a teaching fellowship at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, in 2004-05. And I get out to Michigan in early 2004, mm-hmm. But it was April. Was it later in...
I think that's right.
Was it later in the summer?
Or was it... When was his birthday? It was very close to his birthday.
Yeah. Anyway, I literally had just turned up at Michigan, mm-hmm. To move in with Catherine in the house we had in Lansing. When I got the phone call from David saying his cancer was back. And I'd sort of been aware of this health crisis he'd had, you know, the problem in Arizona and Australia, becoming a diabetic. But it was, again, it was this, I'm remote, you know, if I'd been really close mm-hmm. here, I'd learn a lot more. Anyway.
August.
That's right. So, yeah, so I got to Michigan in May and spent most of that summer bouncing back and forth between Michigan and Wisconsin. During his final illness. And by this point, I mean, we've been working on Volume 4 for several years now. Just trying to design a damn thing was complex mm-hmm. and huge. And then we had to figure out, who's going to write this stuff? And we realized at that point that Graham really was not pulling his weight. So, I mean, his line was, well, I'll do this, but I've really got to focus on getting tenure at Princeton. Because as Ivy, they don't give tenure to very many people. So on. Okay, so when are you going to do work? You know, so he's on the one hand, he's touting himself as being editor of Volume 4 of the History of Cartography. On the other hand, he's not doing the work he should be doing. And this came to a head a couple of months after David died. I'm in Michigan, and so we call and Mary, who brooks no nonsense when she's in her Mrs. Pedley middle school teacher mode, basically calls them up. We call them up from Mary's office at Clements and basically say, you know, what are you doing? Are you going to participate as a fourth editor or not? And he get all bent out of shape that we're calling him out, and goes off to talk to his mentor, and his mentor basically says, yeah, quit. So next day he calls back, yeah, I'll quit. Mm-hmm. So Graham disappears. So Mary and I then spend the time that I'm in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, spending lunch breaks and stuff. And the library is in her school computers, in the computers in her school library, putting together the entry terms list, the authors, you know, trying to finalize all that. Mm-hmm. In that 1 year between David's death, August of 14, and July 15. August 04, and then July 05 when I take over as the project director. So we lose some stuff. We lose some time. I'm just trying to deal with David's death.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, and then we try to set up this database, and the database took time to set up because it's a lot more complex than it should have been, or I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally get to the point where we can start issuing invitations, and life is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first entries come back in, and I look at the first one, and it is the biggest load of shite I have read by one of the experts in the field. We went to this guy, he's the expert. And it's atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
What the photon do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, so I was spending a lot of time trying to figure out, when I was here, both how to continue the project, because the project needs a PI for federal grants, and the university regulates who can be PIs, principal investigators. You have to have a PhD in a cognate field. Fine. Drew can't be the PI. PI, she doesn't have a PhD. Needs to be me, or someone like me, but it needs to be somebody who's employed here. So, but I'm only on leave, and I'm trying to find a job here, and getting a lot of good feedback from various departments, but they're all like, well, you know, if we go to the dean and we ask for a position for you, and we get it, then when the next person retires, the dean will say, well, I just gave you somebody.